Good evening, and thank you very much, Rabbi Finkelstein, for that very warm introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here down south in Memphis to enjoy your southern hospitality. And I did not realize when Rabbi Finkelstein asked me, really a couple of months ago, to speak about the topic of immigration and halacha, I don't think that I had any idea about how timely a topic this was going to be. So I know that there are different opinions and there are different viewpoints, and I will try to be not only halakhically correct, but also as politically correct as possible in terms of my presentation, not to alienate anybody who might be on either side of the fence of this debate, so to speak. But I think that it is important to introduce a Jewish perspective and to present the different sides of the equation so that we can evaluate this issue as responsibly as possible, not only as members of the Jewish faith, but also in terms of using our Jewish faith as a means of informing us in terms of how we should deal with this issue from the perspective of being responsible United States citizens as well. The RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, sent around a notice. Just yesterday I received this notice that they joined 25 or so other Jewish organizations in issuing a statement in opposition of the current immigration policy that has been articulated by our United States government. The new policy is apparently described as a zero-tolerance policy. The result of this means that if there are individuals who enter the country illegally, generally they're coming from Mexico to cross the Mexican border into the United States, then the parents can be separated from their children. Parents will be in prison, and the children are taken away from the parents. Apparently, there's not even, if I understood correctly, a clear path right now to reunite the parents and the children definitively at some future point in time. And there's even confusion about whether there's a way in which anybody could be assured of doing it in a fashion that they would be protected. There's some discussion about whether, for example, the illegal immigrants would enter through what's known as portals of entry. If they apply through portals of entry, then maybe that's considered to be a safer process. But apparently, even then, it's not assured that parents won't be separated from children. A number of people have spoken out against this zero-tolerance policy. I believe that one of the former first ladies, who was a Republican first lady, Laura Bush, I believe wrote something in opposition to this policy as well. And the RCA and I believe the OU joined in the statement that says, I'll just read the relevant part as a launching pad for the rest of our discussion this evening. It's addressed to the Attorney General. They say, Dear Attorney General Sessions, apparently he's the one who articulated this policy, and Secretary Nielsen, on behalf of the 26th, that was the number that appeared, maybe it's changed since then, undersigned the organization and saying institutions, we write to express our strong opposition to the recently expanded zero-tolerance policy that includes separating children from their migrant parents when they cross the border. This policy undermines the values of our nation and jeopardizes the safety and well-being of thousands of people. And then they speak about what they believe is the Jewish perspective. As Jews, we understand the plight of being an immigrant, fleeing violence and oppression. We believe that the United States is a nation of immigrants. Now, we treat the stranger reflects on the moral values and ideals of this nation. Many of these migrant families are seeking asylum in the United States to escape violence in Central America. Taking children away from their families is unconscionable. And then it goes on to say, our Jewish faith demands of us concern for the stranger in our midst. That's a reference to the term Gercha Asher Bisharecha. Our own people's history as strangers reminds us of the many struggles faced by immigrants today and compels our commitment to an immigration system in this country that is compassionate and just. We urge you to immediately rescind the zero-tolerance policy and uphold the values of family, unity and justice on which our nation was built. I don't think that this was intended to serve as a partisan statement to be the Republican or a Democrat. I think that the idea was that whichever side of the aisle you're on, if you have a Jewish sensibility, then this was, they felt, the perspective that we should take. I imagine that some of us are reminded of the statement that's carved in a bronze plaque at the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty by the Jewish poet Emma Lazarus. Emma Lazarus lived during the 19th century, not that long. She lived 1849 to 1887. She died at the tender age of 38. And I think she had lymphoma. I think that she died of that disease on her return from a trip to Europe. But she was a great poet. And she was also literally a Jewish thinker. She was somebody who was an early proponent of Zionism, before it was even called Zionism, of seeing to it that Jews should have their own state. And she was, interestingly, not an immigrant herself. Her forebears went back to the time prior to the American Revolution, when they lived in America. She had one grandfather, I think, who came from Germany, but everybody else had been there for years and years. But she wrote a poem about the importance of taking care of immigrants that really was a major cornerstone of the American attitude during a time that many Jews were fleeing from oppression and difficult circumstances in financial from Eastern Europe in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. And this really was what the American value system stood for a long period of time. But we've seen what has happened as Jews when this hasn't been so fully the attitude. Everybody is familiar, but it bears repeating with the horrible story of the MS St. Louis, the ship that was sent with German refugees in 1939, looking for safe harbor in the United States. It was turned away. Turned away at that point. The United States took a much harsher position towards immigration. These refugees, approximately 950 Jewish refugees from Europe, were turned away by the United States. They were turned away by Cuba. They were turned away by Canada. And they were sent back, many of them, to their deaths. They were taken in by certain countries, including the UK, which was good, Belgium, the Netherlands, various countries, where France, where many of them ended up being shipped off to, sent off to death camps anyway. Approximately 250 of them died in death camps because this boat, had it been allowed into the United States, it would have assured their safety and their freedom, turned them all away. There was a book written about it called Voyage of the Damned. It was then turned into a movie by the same name, Voyage of the Damned. And we're reminded of the horror of sending back somebody who is fleeing from oppression and cruelty, trying to find a safe harbor, of what the consequences are when you don't have a compassionate immigration policy. So what about these references to what the Judaism, the Torah, has to say, these constant references in the RCAOU message that of other Jewish organizations referring to the stranger in our midst? What does the Torah really have to say about the stranger in our midst? The Torah wasn't written in English. The Torah was written in Hebrew. So the term that the Torah uses for the stranger in our midst, the term is ger. So what does ger mean when the Torah says many times, ger shevi sharecha lo sa'azvenu, you shall not abandon the stranger, ger lo sonev lo silchatzenu, you shall not oppress the stranger, rav temes ager, you should love the stranger. So in general, the term ger in the Torah refers to one of two different types of people. It either refers to what we call a ger. We deal here, one of the matters that I deal with when I come to Memphis is geirus, people who want to convert to Judaism. Somebody who converts to Judaism is called a ger. a convert, a righteous convert to Judaism, is called the Ger Tzedek. So many of the verses, such as Rav Temes Ager, showing special love and compassion to a Ger, referring to somebody who converts to Judaism. It's another type of Ger that is also referred to in many of the psukim that discuss Ger, and that's a Ger Toshav. It means somebody who hasn't converted to Judaism, but when we have the sovereign state in Israel and somebody wants to, a non-Jewish person, wants to become a citizen, somebody wants to settle in the land. So the Torah indicates that there's a special status for somebody who's a Ger Toshav. And they're going to live in the land, they don't have to become Jewish, but they should accept the basic civilized laws of nations, the seven Noahide laws. They should accept the seven basic laws that are binding upon all humanity: not to steal, not to kill, not to worship idols, etc. Such a person is deserving of special treatment. Can sojourn in the land of Israel and is supposed to be taken care of. But it's a very specific context. Neither of those contexts is referring to stranger in the broadest sense, the way that we would translate idea of taking care of the stranger. It means this person did not start off as a member of the faith or even necessarily a member of the land, but they're prepared to accept a certain precept, certain principle, certain code of conduct, either to join the faith entirely or to at least follow certain rules and to abide by a sense of allegiance and loyalty to the sovereign nation of Israel and the land of Israel. And then there are various laws that are applicable to them. So can we extrapolate from there to really address the immigration issue here in the United States? So the answer is that to a certain degree, I think that it is appropriate in the sense that we have to look at the spirit of the law. What is Judaism, what is Jewish law teaching us about basic values of how we treat somebody who's coming in from the outside, in terms of what our responsibilities are towards them, in terms of what their responsibilities are towards the indigenous population. The Ramban writes in Sefer Shmos, Perek Chafes, Pasuk Chaf, on the Pasuk that speaks about how you shall not oppress a ger. V'ger lo sone v'lo sochatzenu, that we're reminded, ki gerim eisem eretz Mitzrayim. We were gerim in Mitzrayim. So you can understand this halachically. When we left Egypt, we also went through a process of conversion at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai. But we also have a principle, ein mikra yotzei midei pshuta. You have to look at the literal words of the pasuk. Literal words of the verse say, we were strangers. We were strangers in the land of Egypt, and we have to remember how we were mistreated at that time. Says the Ramban, kini roa dimas ha'ashukim asher ein lohem menachem. It's an allusion to a verse in Ecclesiastes and Koheles, that the Torah is saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, I see the tears of the oppressed, the dimasa ashukin, asher ein lahem menachem. They don't have anyone to comfort them. They come all alone, abandoned, separated from their family roots. Especially imagine that they only come with parents and children, and you're going to do the act of separation between parent and child. The oppressors have all the force, they have all the might. My job, says God, is that I have to rescue all of those who are alone and forlorn from those who would oppress them, those who really don't have bearings, those who don't have a built-in protection. They have nothing to trust in other than God himself. Then the Ramban adds, says there's another verse that adds another consideration, and that verse in the Torah says, you know what it's like to be a ger, because you were similarly situated when you were in Egypt. Klomar, that is to say, says the Ramban, then anybody, and here he's talking simply about the notion of someone who's settling from the outside. He's not talking about a halakhic ger, a halakhic convert to Judaism. per se. It says anybody who comes from the outside, they are very much in distress. Because they don't have a support system. And this is a person who sighs and who cries out. And they can only look to Hashem for help. And Hashem is saying that it's important to have mercy for such a person, the same way that Hashem had mercy on us when we cried out from our oppression, from our servitude, when we were in Egypt, and it says we cried out from our servitude by Yizaku, Batal Shavasam Elokim in Avoda, and our cries went up to Hashem from our terrible situation of servitude and subordination. In other words, the Ramban is saying there's a message here in these laws. And the message in these laws is to have sympathy for those who do not have a built-in support system, who are coming from the outside, because we can should remember what it was like for us when we didn't have a support system, when we were treated as foreigners in the land, when we were slaves in Egypt. And the Sforno, in his commentary, in the very same Pasuk, in Shmos Perek Chof Beis, similarly writes that he says, Ulefisha einem yodim binyanei ha'aretz. He says that why do you have to be so solicitous of those who come from the outside? Because they are not familiar with the ways of the land. They're coming from outside of the land. So davar kal hu lehonosam. It's very easy to commit acts of cruelty towards them that you might not get away with if you're dealing with people who already have certain rights and have certain claims to the land. Therefore, hisir alei makasav. Therefore, that's why the Torah has special prohibitions with respect to such individuals. It's very interesting. If you look in the commentary of the Ibn Ezra always has interesting things to say if you look hard enough. Ibn Ezra, in his commentary to Bereishis Perek Tezvah, Pasuk Yud Gimel, gives you the etymology of the word ger. Ger, translated as stranger, halakhically it's used to refer to a convert, righteous settler of the land. He says, where does the word ger come from? He says, it comes from the word gargir. It comes from the word gargir, which means a grape, a single grape, a berry, which is removed from the comfort and the protection of its cluster. B'tam ger kemo ha-gargir shenichras min ha-se'if. It's ripped off from the rest of the cluster and it's just lying there all alone. A delicious, wonderful grape. Why shouldn't you be nice to grapes? You don't want to trample on a grape unless you're going to make wine out of it. But it's a grape that is all alone and therefore it deserves our attention. It's a raisin in the sun, so to speak. So the spirit of the law and our own experiences seem to be consistent with a sense of compassion towards those who are in this type of situation. I saw a column by Rabbi Shalom Carmi. Rabbi Shalom Carmi is the editor-in-chief of the Rabbinical Council of America Journal of Jewish Thought, known as Tradition. Tradition is a very renowned Torah journal. The editor was originally Rabbi Norman Lamb, I think for many years, and it was Rabbi Walter Wurzberger for many years. For the last number of years, it's been Rabbi Shalom Carmi, who's also a Bible professor of mine at Yeshiva College. And he quotes in a discussion in one of his essays that he published in the Tradition Journal just a couple of years ago. He quotes an interpretation of the Netziv, of Avraham's conversation with Ephron Hachiti. When Avraham came to Hebron and he needed to bury his wife Sarah, he wasn't really a resident of the land, even though he was entitled to the land in terms of his descendants, but he wasn't a resident of the land. So he bargained with Ephron Hachiti for a burial plot to bury his wife Sarah. And he said, Ger v'soshav anochi imachem. He didn't mean I'm a ger tzedek. He meant ger v'toshav. He meant I'm a stranger, but I'm also a resident together with you. The combination of ger v'toshav contained both a plea for sympathy, someone in need, and an assurance of his ongoing relationship with Hebron based on his past connection with Hebron, because he had lived there, and his future intention. And Rabbi Carmi writes that this is akin to that of an immigrant making his case to an established populace. Making his case, a very vulnerable, difficult situation to be in, but this is what Avraham told us. This is what Avraham enunciated. That we know the difficulties and the travails of being placed in that type of situation. It's very challenging. So much so that Rabbi Karmi notes that both Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban quote this interaction that Avraham needed to endure with Ephron Hachiti as the last in the culmination of his Asara Nisyonos, of the 10 trials and tribulations of Avraham Avinu, that after all that he had accomplished in life, after all of his status and stature and his tremendous impact on the world around him, he found himself, once he was an immigrant coming into a strange land, trying to bargain for certain rights in this incredibly vulnerable situation. And this was perhaps the ultimate, even after Akedas Yitzchak, of all of his trials and tribulations. Now you can add to all of this the notion of asylum. Because when you speak about somebody who is fleeing from torture, this only adds an additional dimension to the responsibility that we might have towards somebody over and above the importance of being compassionate to a foreigner, a stranger in general. The Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, Perichov Gimel, Pasuk Tezvav, teaches us a mitzvah, Lo Saskiv Eved El Adonav. You have a slave that escaped his master outside of Israel. He's talking about our responsibilities in the sovereign state of Israel. And this slave runs and flees to the land of Israel. We're told you're not allowed to restore this slave. You're not allowed to extradite him to go back to his original master. You have to provide him with asylum. You have to provide the slave with a safe harbor. And the Torah then goes on to say, you have to let him stay with you, whatever place he wants to go, whatever place he chooses. You have to take care of him. You have to make sure that you take good care of him, that you ensure that his acclimation will be a pleasant one, will be a good one. You're not allowed to oppress him in any way. And the Sefer Achinuch quotes this as not just one mitzvah, but two separate mitzvahs. You can't send him back. And you also have to take care of him. And says that there was no time limitation. Certain mitzvahs, when we say, this mitzvah is only applicable when we have the Jubilee, when we have the Yovel. This mitzvah is only applicable at the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Sefer Chinuch says this mitzvah never goes away. This mitzvah is always applicable. Now, of course, as far as the technical details of the law are concerned, the Rambam learns that we're speaking about a slave that already has a certain halakhic status, certain responsibilities in terms of the laws that he has to keep of the Torah, and then when you keep him in the land of Israel, you effectively have to make sure that he becomes emancipated. Once the slave becomes emancipated, he becomes a full-fledged Jew, he becomes obligated in all of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. But again, we have to look at the spirit of the law that is reflected in this passage as well. And the spirit of the law is spelled out by no one but the Rambam himself in his explanation of the reasons for laws of the Torah that is contained in his philosophical work, the Mora Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. So in the third section of the Guide to the Perplexed, in the 39th chapter, the Rambam says that with respect to such an individual, it's not enough to give assistance alone. We must look after the interests and be kind to people who have fled from oppression and not hurt their feelings afterwards. And he says, why is that? Because we are supposed to have a sense of compassion and mercy. The Sefer HaChinuch also says, V'chol zeh lehoel le'amo ki chafetz chesed hu. All of this is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu desires mercy, and we're supposed to emulate the ways of God in terms of exercising mercy. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi, Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, former chief rabbi of England, eloquently writes about this as well in several columns when he speaks about the special responsibility we as the Jewish people have towards immigrants, and how we have been rescued in various points in history when we've been taken in, when we were fleeing oppression and possible death if we weren't going to be embraced. he points out that the fate of the city of Sodom was only sealed because of the cruelty that they exercised towards strangers. And he also makes an interesting observation. He says that it's been noted by many commentators that there are many, many places in the Torah where we're told about the mitzvah of loving the ger, right? Which we, again, from a halakhic perspective, it speaks about loving the convert, but he says that we don't find nearly as many references to v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, to loving your fellow man. And he says that the reicha means somebody who grew up in the same circumstances as you did. Maybe it was necessary to have so many more references when it comes to loving and reaching out to the ger, because it's not something that comes quite as naturally. People are naturally suspicious of the other and more inclined to be xenophobic on that basis. However, there is a flip side to the equation. You're probably wondering when I would get to it. So the flip side of the equation is the continuation of the Rambam. So the Rambam goes on in this discussion of the underpinnings of the mitzvah of not returning a slave, a fugitive slave, to his master. The Rambam says that this does not apply to evildoers. He says when it comes to people who are evildoers, people who are a threat to your security, so then there's no sanctuary. Then we have a different pasuk, which says, "Mi'im mizbachi tekachenu lamus." Somebody, for example, committed a capital offense, they're a murderer, and they go into the Beis HaMikdash and they cling to the Mizbeach. Like, yo, right? They cling to the Mizbeach, to the holy altar, they don't get to claim sanctuary. You take them from the Mizbeach and you give them the punishment that they deserve. And he applies the general principle that we find in Chazal, that if you show too much compassion to those who are evildoers, somebody who misplaces their compassion, and instead of being compassionate for the weak and the vulnerable, is compassionate towards the terrorist and the evildoer, they will end up hurting the good guys in the process. So there is a balance that the Rambam points out that has to be maintained. And even Rabbi Karmi in his essay says that we all acknowledge that there's a certain danger to the notion of, say, open borders. And particularly, the first one is the one that we've just articulated, which is the safety and security concerns. We're not obligated, per se, to endanger ourselves by bringing in people who are murderers and terrorists. There does have to be some sort of a vetting process that has to be very carefully evaluated. Now, at the same time, you can't be overly zealous in this regard either. If you just decide that everyone is a potential terrorist and you don't want to take possible risk upon yourself, so then you're going to end up being unnecessarily cruel. You can't be too extensive in how you apply this analysis. There was a classical machlokis, a dispute among earlier authorities, whether in general, leaving aside the immigration issue, I see somebody drowning and I know that if I try to save them, I'm going to be endangering myself. Am I obligated to place myself in possible danger in order to save somebody from certain danger? There's a Talmud Yerushalmi that indicates yes, but we don't paskin that way. We rule that there is no obligation to place yourself in possible danger in order to save somebody from certain danger, like the ruling of the Radvaz. But nonetheless, even the Radvaz says, don't make too much a habit out of making this type of a calculation. That on occasion, it's okay to place yourself in temporary danger. The Aruch HaShulchan, in his discussion of this issue towards the end of the Laws of Chosh and Mishpat, says similarly that one should not overly calculate, and you shouldn't be overly conservative in how you're going to assess that it's not proper to take certain risks in order to save people's lives. And therefore, it's important to be responsible in an assessment that somebody really poses a risk before there is a treatment that is accorded based upon that type of assumption. Other types of considerations that every country takes into account is the economic well-being of a country. making sure that the way in which others are integrated doesn't increase unemployment, doesn't cause excessive drops in wages. And another concern that people have is to maintain basic cultural norms, that there should be a cohesive society. So we have that to some degree as well. If you think about the idea of the Ger Toshev is supposed to, at the very least, respect the sovereign land, pay misim ba'anonus, to pay the basic taxes that have to be paid to the land, not to be a fifth column, so to speak, within the country, and to accept certain basic civilized norms of behavior, what we would call the seven Noahide laws. But Rabbi Kami concludes by saying that even though these are all valid considerations, we can't help but be moved by the humanitarian plight of refugees knocking on our doors, as we said, to save their lives. Now, there was, interestingly enough, I have to mention, because this was also a controversial issue, to show that the issues that the world writ large grapples with, we've grappled with, in terms of our own Jewish legal tradition as well, and there have been different opinions, which is why it's always good to look at the Torah perspective so we can have an appreciation of some of the challenges that society today needs to deal with and figure out how we can best inform and advise the debate through the prism of the Torah. There's a big debate about something called Cheskas HaYishuv, which was an economic debate for the most part. Cheskas HaYishuv meant that there were different Jewish communities in Europe where there were settled communities where people had lived there for a while. The question was, if some Jewish business person from outside of their town, outside of their city, wanted to move in and wanted to establish their own business and their own enterprise, could they actually stop people from moving in, saying, we have enough Jews, and we have a stable economy right now, and if you move in, maybe you're going to take away from other people's livelihood, and we don't want you here. This wasn't a question of Jews keeping out non-Jews or anything of that. This was Jews keeping out fellow Jews from joining the community. Could they say such a thing as a cheskas hayishuv? It's all predicated upon a Gemara in Baba Basra that says that we generally allow for free enterprise and for different businesses to open up in the same town. But if somebody comes from an outside town and they want to open up a business and compete with the local merchants, we don't allow them unless they pay the local taxes. So do we have a right to say to somebody who says, okay, I'm going to come in and pay the local taxes, say, we're not going to let you. We don't want you to come in. We don't want you to come in and pay the taxes. We don't want your taxes, and we don't want your business participation. The Gemara is silent on the issue. It doesn't seem to indicate that you have a right to exclude anybody. So there's a division. The Aruch HaShulchan HaKol Shemishpa Simen Kuv Nun Vav discusses how there was a dispute among different Rishonim about this point. It was Rashi and a bunch of other Rishonim who felt that you could exclude somebody based on economic considerations of keeping the community viable. There were other considerations too. They worried that maybe it would engender anti-Semitism. If the local authorities saw that there were too many Jews in a particular place, they would start to notice more if there were too many Jews. I don't know if I should mention this, but I started traveling to Europe. I'd never done that in all my early years, but now I go on Federation trips sometimes. They send me to Europe. So I traveled to a few places over the last several years. One of them was Paris, and one of them was Vienna. So Paris, there are a lot of Jews in Vienna. There's a lot of Jews in Paris. In Vienna, there were very few Jews. But when I arrived in Paris, I arrived in both places early in the morning, and I hadn't had a chance to daven Shachris yet, so I put on my towels and fell in the airport like I do every place here in America. I don't think twice about it. Never got into trouble here in America for doing it. In Paris, they walked over to me and they stopped me on the spot and said, we don't do that here. You can't put on towels and fill in the airport. It's like a secular culture. This is, you know, you're going, it's like incendiary behavior. So I had to take off the towels and the tefillin. In Vienna, nobody could care less with towels and tefillin in front of everybody, and it was perfectly fine. But why? You figure it should be exactly the opposite. In Paris, there's so many more Jews, but that's exactly it. There's much more of a feeling, I think, of a threat when you have many, many more Jews than when you hardly have anyone. In Vienna, there's hardly any Jewish population. They couldn't care less what I did. So this was a concern. The Jews were worried that they would become too multitudinous in a particular place, so maybe it would engender anti-Semitism. So there was a big, robust debate about whether this idea of Cheskas a Yishuv is an appropriate thing, or whether Cheskas a Yishuv is not an appropriate thing. The Aruch HaShulchan, in his discussion, comes to the conclusion that when we're dealing with a memshala, when we're dealing with a kingdom, with a government, which allows Jews to be there, sort of what he would call a malchus shecheset, certainly we have that here in America, so he says, lo shayecha takana zuklal. If you're going to make a takana, he said, of cheskas hayishuv, and say that it's something that should be exercised when there's a compelling need, so he says there's certainly no compelling need in this day and age. If you live in a place where you don't have to worry about people attacking the Jews and the like, so there's no justification for keeping people out based on economic considerations, but rather it is appropriate to allow anybody to move into the community. So you can extrapolate from this Cheskas HaYishuv discussion that our general netiyah, our general inclination, is towards allowing people to come in. And even those who felt that for economic considerations, it is sometimes appropriate to keep people out, had a carve-out clause. They had an exception in one particular case. And what was that exception? The exception was when the people who were trying to move in were fleeing enemies who would otherwise have killed them. This is expressly enunciated by the Mordechai in his commentary to Maseches Baba Kama. For those who are taking notes, Os Tav Kuf Yud Tes, where the Mordechai says this, that even according to those opinions who held that exclusion for economic reasons could ever be justified, it is not justified when the people who are coming in need to stay, whether it's on a temporary basis or a permanent basis, in order to save their skin, in order to rescue themselves from oppressors and from tyrants and from terrorists who would otherwise kill them. There was I came across an article by the rabbi of the Jewish Center in the Upper West Side, Rabbi Yossi Levin, and he noted that there was an op-ed that was written by Brett Stevens. I think he's, what is he, the editor of the Wall Street Journal or a columnist for the Wall Street Journal? Now he's with the New York Times. Okay. So he wrote, a modest immigration proposal banned Jews. Apparently trying to be provocative, so he didn't really mean to ban Jews, but what he was saying was sometimes there's an excuse, a rationalization that an entire people, an entire population should be kept out because there are bad apples, because some of them are murderers and some of them are rapists and some of them are thieves and the like. He said you could have adopted exactly the same attitude towards Jewish immigrants. He said some of them were communist sympathizers, some of them were mob bosses. There were, I don't have to mention names, he mentioned names, I don't feel comfortable mentioning names. There were Jews in the early part of the century who were known as bad guys, shall we say, people who did very, very bad things. But would we have wanted the entire population to be discriminated against because there were a few bad apples? So by the same token, the Jews have, thank God, made a tremendously positive contribution, I believe. I think we would all agree. I think even those not in this room would agree to the United States in overwhelming numbers and in terms of everything that has been contributed by the Jewish population. But we have to also bear in mind that even if there are some bad apples among other peoples, there can be many, many very good people, and you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, and completely expel and eliminate or prevent a population from coming in because of the fact that there are some bad actors. I saw in another article, there was a good article by Rabbi Klatskin. He lives in Dayton, Ohio. He's a Chabad rabbi, and he wrote an article together with a. The other rabbi is, I think, Rabbi Mengel, they wrote that there you have to bear in mind as well that the Torah tells us Mishpat Echad Yiyeh Lachem Lager. I think they said this by the same token, when there has to be a basic premise when you do allow people to come into the country, that those who are coming in are prepared to abide by the same mishpat echad, by the same legal system, like the same way that we require from the ger toshav, that the ger toshav, the resident stranger, should take upon the basic practices of civilized legal norms. So it's not unreasonable to require that at least the people should make a pledge to be loyal to the state and to abide by the laws. Finally, I saw an article by a Rav in Eretz Yisrael. I think it's with Malay, the Yeshiva Malay Gilboa. His name is Rabbi Yeshua Gilad. So he quotes what the Rambam writes in a different context and said, this is an important statement of the Rambam that we should bear in mind when speaking about these issues. She'ein mishpatei ha-Torah nekama ba'olam. That the laws of the Torah, and these are the laws that we view as the guiding light that all the nations should look at in terms of informing a proper value system, they're not meant to be vengeful, God will, God forbid. Ela rachamim v'chesed v'shalom ba'olam. Rather, the laws of the Torah are intended to display compassion and kindness and to bring about peace. So we who have suffered from discrimination should be careful not to discriminate unfairly against others, especially minorities and especially refugees. So I'll just conclude by saying that from all of the above, what seems like a reasonable conclusion from our perspective, from a Torah vantage point, is that we should support an immigration policy that is both humane and responsible in consonance with Torah values, both in Eretz Yisrael, in our Jewish homeland, and here in the Malchus Shel Chesed, in this kingdom of kindness of the United States, the land that has been so good to the Jewish people and to all other nations and peoples throughout the world since the time of its foundation. And this is something that we should strongly support. So thank you very much and have a good night.
Rabbi, it's great to take some questions. So just remind everybody, please make questions rather than statements and be respectful. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yes?
Rabbi, it seems like the halachic perspective recognizes the extremes. Someone who's fleeing oppression, fleeing danger, there's an obligation of it. But we also have an obligation to keep out the bad guys. What about the vast majority of the middle that are simply coming to look for work? They're not being oppressed, they're not running away from oppression. They may not be bad guys, but they're simply coming looking for work. And it's an overwhelming numbers. How would the halakha deal with that?
So the first part of our discussion today just spoke about the general attitude towards people coming from the outside. That was the idea of the ger, or the idea of the ger that we mentioned. Then afterwards, we spoke about the extra measure of responsibility that we bear towards those who are seeking sanctuary. So I think that, you know, with respect to those who are just looking for work, then you have to bear in mind, I suppose, the two sides of the debate regarding the idea of the cheskas hayishuv. You have a right to keep people out, even if they're willing to play by the rules, even if they're willing to pay the necessary taxes and to earn all of the privileges through hard work and industrious labor in order to preserve the economic well-being of the indigenous population. And there were two different schools of thought when it came to this issue. So I can't say definitively that one school of thought is more correct than the other school of thought. However, it does seem that, at least from the presentation of the Aruch HaShulchan, that the school of thought that says that if somebody is prepared to earn their keep and to play by the rules, that it's appropriate to really give them a chance. And from a Musar perspective, when we think about how much we as a people have benefited when there have been others who have had that perspective towards us, such as when you had the Jewish immigrant experience into the United States. So therefore, it becomes even more appropriate for us to take that stance and to adopt that particular position. Obviously, it has to be done in a way that's not going to cause economic ruination to those who are already in place, and it has to be done in a way in which the people coming in are not going to be parasitical which is not going to be, as I think some of the writers on this subject have expressed, shelo yehi chotei nisker, that somebody who is flouting and violating the system shouldn't benefit from the system, that you should have people who are prepared to be hardworking, who are prepared to work their way up, and who are prepared to play by the rules. But if that is the orientation, then I think that everybody gains in the final analysis. Yes.
Escaped and managed to walk days and months and get into Israel, were willing to work and not necessarily be a burden to the Israeli society. And some of them have been there a long time. They have families, they have children who are born in Israel, who only speak Hebrew, who have gone to Israeli schools. And again, they're in this flux situation of having being deported or going back to a country because the regime has changed and perhaps they won't be so persecuted anymore. It's a big problem, not only in America, it's a big problem for Israel. So, and they are far more subject to halacha than the United States is.
I completely agree with you. So you may have noticed in my concluding remarks, I said I think that this is a type of perspective that we need to take not only here in the United States, but in the state of Israel. I think that we need to take this perspective as well. There was a major discussion in Israel about the plight of, I believe it's the Sudanese refugees, and to the extent that they are fleeing from oppression and it's a humanitarian crisis, then it seems to me that's something that we in particular should take very, very seriously in terms of figuring out how we can protect individuals and populations who are in that predicament. You know, obviously at the same time, the security of our own nation needs to be preserved, but assuming that can be properly safeguarded and accomplished, then people who are refugees from oppression should not be looked at as bad guys, but to a certain degree, our responsibility. Okay, I'll take one more question, and then, you know, I think probably have to
come. In precedent in the Torah, you know, it's not the Givonim. The Givonim, they lied in their application, and they were relegated to second-class status, right? I mean, they were fleeing oppression, or they didn't want to be killed, or, you know, and they showed up, but they misrepresented themselves at the border, and we see that they let them stay.
So number one, they let them stay. But number two, there are consequences for actions. It's not necessary to lie and to cheat and to claw one's way in. That we have protocols where people can do things in a fashion which is honest and which is and which is upfront. And that's the way in which we can expect those who want to come in to present themselves. There was a system that according to many commentators, was in place for them to have been able to come in more honestly. So, you know, that's on some level a good example of how the system, you know, really works. But both sides have to discharge their responsibility properly. So it is a two-way street in that regard. You know, you have also the example of Ammon and Moab. When we were passing through the Ammon and Moab, so the men, the Ammoni men and the Moabi men didn't come out to help us out as we were, you know, refugees, so to speak, from Egypt, and we're going through the desert and we needed a little bit of help and support, and they just completely abandoned us, and therefore they were excluded from being part of our people. He said if they're not allowed to marry, if they should convert to Judaism, they can't, you know, marry those who were born Jewish. Why is it that there was such a harsh rule that was imposed upon them? Because they didn't exercise this basic humanitarianism. Okay, we'll stop there.
Thank you so much. And one word. Firstly, we want to thank the rabbi for sharing with us. It's a very, very informative and thoughtful talk, and balanced as well. Thank you very much. Thank you each for joining us. So in a moment, we'll dive in my women over here, men over here. Thank you.